Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Monday, December 10th. My name is Rob Doster. I have a good show on the way for you today. I was able to catch up with my buddy from Yahoo Sports, Jeff Eisenberg, and we got into all of the overreactions from the last week of college hoops. We talked about Gonzaga, Tennessee. We talked about Kentucky. We talked about where Kansas should be ranked. We talked about Kansas State. It's a good conversation. It's enjoyable. I think it's informative, and I hope that you guys are going to enjoy it. Before we get into that, I have to make the usual ask. Please rate, please review, please subscribe to this podcast in any app that you listen to podcasts in, any interactions that you have with it, whether it's rating it, reviewing it, subscribing to it, downloading it. It really does help us within the metrics. It helps us within the rankings. It makes my bosses happy. When my bosses are happy, I'm happy. When I'm happy, you are getting a better show. So throwing me 5 stars and saying something nice about me is going to better your life. So go ahead, hit me with those 5 stars. And let's get into that conversation with Jeff Eisenberg. And now I'd like to welcome back onto the podcast one of my favorite guests. He is Jeff Eisenberg. He writes for Yahoo Sports. He's located in Southern California, which means he has access to the best beer on the planet. So Jeff, before we actually start talking about college hoops, one, how are you doing, man? Two, congratulations. I understand you have another child on the way. And three, I'm going to need your best brewery that you found in like the last year. Any new discoveries that you found? Because we always kick off our podcast this way.
So one, I'm doing good. Two, yes, child number two on the way in a few weeks. So we're busy prepping for that. And three, I will give a shout out to Green Cheeks Brewery in Orange County. It's in the city of Orange, and the best new brewery that I've had recently. Really, really good IPAs. I would encourage anyone and everyone who is in the Southern California area to check that out. If you're here for Disneyland, that will make your night go a lot smoother if you have a growler of that to return to in the hotel room.
Yeah, I've actually found a pretty good one. You know, outside of Philly, there aren't a ton of great breweries here. And, you know, I don't think I have to explain this to you, but for people that maybe don't know, I'm a big IPA guy, and IPAs on the East Coast just aren't as good as IPAs on the West Coast.
Truth.
So, like, even New England style IPAs are good, but the stuff you get out West, it's something with the hops, right? It's the climate and the way that you can grow the hops out there. Just makes it a little bit fresher. And like Philly does have access, like Russian River distributes in Philly now. So I can find like Pliny and stuff like that around here, but it's just not the same. It's not as good. That stuff.
Yeah. Like you can find great IPAs on the East Coast. Like obviously the stuff in Vermont and in New Hampshire is terrific. And, you know, even like some of the longstanding ones like Hialeah from Cigar City in Florida is good, but just for the sheer preponderance of good IPAs out in California in particular, and also in Oregon and Seattle too. Yeah, I think it's pretty hard to beat.
Yeah, the Wegmans by me actually started carrying lunch, which was pretty nice. And
oh, that is nice.
For the people out there that are like the three beer snob listeners that we have, lunch is it's from Maine. It's kind of hard to get nationally, but it's in the Wegmans right down the street from me. So I've been buying a lot of them. It's expensive though, man. Like a 16.9-ounce bottle is like $7.
And yeah, so, like, I have a birthday coming up in addition to Christmas, and all I ask people for is gift certificates to liquor stores so that I don't have to feel bad about getting expensive beers like that.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to explain. Like when you go to the liquor store and you come back with a 6-pack and it costs $50.
Right. You know,
that's a tough conversation to have. But yeah, so I have found a fun little brewery near me called the Cape May Brewing, which is, you know, on Cape May, New Jersey. People on the East Coast are going to know what that is. But it has good IPAs. It actually has a West Coast style IPA that is the best local one that I've found. And I've been trying all of them, man. I've tried everything local to try to find the right brewery and the right IPA around me. And you know, it's not bad. It's like $9 for a 6-pack too. So the bank account is much happier when I drink that than when I drink the fancy stuff.
That's always a good sign.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about college basketball. Obviously, we need to get into Gonzaga, Tennessee at some point. I need to talk about Kentucky falling out of our top 25. Kansas State probably needs a mention as well. But before we dive into all of that, like I mentioned, Jeff, you are on the West Coast, which means that you watch a lot of Pac-12 basketball. So Obviously, this is the Monday Overreactions podcast, so here's my first overreaction for you. The Pac-12 is a one-bid league this year.
I think it's an overreaction, but man, I mean, I don't think it's much of an overreaction. I still think it's a two- or three-bid conference, but you know, I looked it up this morning. I don't know if you saw what I tweeted out, but like their record against the top 50 in KenPom this year is 3-15. Their record against the top 100 in KenPom this year is 10-33. That's not good. You know, like no team in the league has more than one top 50 win. And I don't see if this continues. Like, what is the win in the Pac-12 that if you get it, it resonates? Like, last year, it was Arizona State for a while because of how well they performed out of conference until they imploded down the stretch in league play. But, like, that, like, beating Arizona State, like, boosted everyone else in the conference. This year, who is it? Is it Arizona State again? Is it Oregon? Is it UCLA? I mean, Arizona? Like, you know, I can see a couple of those teams making the NCAA tournament. If I had to guess, I would guess three Pac-12 teams right now. But, like, two wouldn't shock me, and two would be more likely to me than four right now. So, I don't know. I mean, the conference has, what, 3-4 weeks left in non-league play, and it needs to come up with some wins. Like, they need UCLA to beat Ohio State, or they need you know, Arizona State to pick off Kansas. So they need some of these marquee wins and not any more than near misses like you saw from Stanford and from Washington and a couple of others recently.
Yeah, and some of the best teams have already missed on all their chances, right? Like Arizona already lost to Gonzaga and Auburn, and then they just lost on Sunday at Alabama, which certainly isn't going to help. UCLA's lost to Michigan State and North Carolina. Like you said, they do play Ohio State, and they play at Cincinnati, which is a game that's going to be winnable for them. I don't know if they'll actually win that. I'm not going to bet on UCLA being able to beat a team that is going to out-tough them. But the big one they got to get is Arizona State. And I think, because you mentioned it, Arizona State is probably the best team in the league, right? Like, I would say, coming into the season, I didn't think that they would be, but based on what we've seen early on this year, you know, the emergence of Lugenstor. Is that how you say it? Lugenstor?
I believe it's Lugenstor.
Yeah. Lugenstor. I'm just going to call him Ludort because that's Ludort. I like that name. But yeah, I mean, it would have been really nice if they could have actually held on to beat Nevada. They were up by, what, like 12 at the half and ended up losing that game. But I think that they are probably, again, the best team in the conference. And that's really not saying all that much because I'm not 100% sold on them actually being really good, right? I just don't think that Oregon is all that good. Like, Oregon's got a serious bowl problem. And I've talked about that on a previous podcast. We probably don't need to dive into it too much. But it's unbelievable for somebody that is as good of a shot blocker as he is that he can be such a defensive liability. So I don't know if I buy into Oregon. I don't, you know, maybe Arizona's going to be the best team in the conference again just because Sean Miller's going to be able to coach them up well enough that they, you know, win enough games in the conference to win the league regular season title. I don't know if Washington has it this year. I thought they'd be a little bit better at this point. Although the game against Gonzaga was a little bit more promising than, I guess, the game against Auburn. What's your take on Washington? How do you feel about them?
I thought they were overrated coming into the season. I think they're good enough to have a chance at the tournament, but I didn't think they were a top 25 team. Like, to get back to Arizona State for a second, like, if you ask me who is playing the best basketball out of any Pac-12 team today, I might agree with you that it's Arizona State, but I would strongly take the field over the Sun Devils in terms of who's going to win the league. I still think UCLA has the most talent in the league. I still trust Arizona a little bit more than I trust Arizona State. I mean, it's just hard for me not – I know it's a different team, and I know it's you know, vastly different roster than last year, but it's hard for me not to be scarred by how Arizona State finished the season last year. I mean, you're talking about a team that beat Kansas and beat Kansas State and beat Xavier in non-league play and then barely scraped into the tournament after losing, what, like 12 out of 14 down the stretch. So I don't trust Arizona State to be able to maintain this as much as, you know, maybe I trust Arizona or UCLA or even Oregon to kind of start to put it together, or especially UCLA and Oregon. Like, UCLA and Oregon are pretty talented and just haven't had the results to back up that talent yet. the concerning thing for the conference, though, is like if you struggle in non-league play in the ACC and then you get hot in February, who cares? You could be a four seed. But if you struggle in non-league play in the Pac-12 right now, like you can win 13 games in the Pac-12 and miss the NCAA tournament, depending on what you do in non-league play. So like there's got to be a real impetus, you know, among teams in that league to do something in December, because if they don't, they're going to put themselves in the situation that a lot of, you know, Atlantic 10 and Mountain West teams over the years have found themselves, where like you have darn near no margin for error in conference play. And I think that's what those upper echelon Pac-12 teams are looking at right now.
Yeah, I think you're going to see a lot of teams that are going to feel like Nebraska did last year, where they
That's a perfect analogy.
They start piling up wins, but none of those wins actually end up doing anything to help them with their resume, because struggles out of conference play have made it so that all of the teams in that conference with their computer profiles just don't look the same as the computer profiles that'll be in the ACC conference.
Yeah, and then like at some point this season, you know, like a USC is going to start to put it together. They'll get Kevin Porter back. There's good talent on that roster. I know they lost a lot from last year, but I think they'll gel eventually. And like at some point in league play, like that's probably not going to be an easy game to win, especially on the road. But you're not going to get any credit for beating USC because of what they've done out of the league. Like the computer numbers are going to look terrible. So like I think that's the problem that the Pac-12 is going to have the rest of the way, and that's why I'm not sure I see them as a one-bid league, but again, two wouldn't shock me, and three seems the most likely scenario as of today.
All right, so let's talk about this Gonzaga-Tennessee game, because I think that that was as entertaining as any game that I've seen this season, probably right up there with Gonzaga and Duke. So before I dive into any thoughts that I have, give me your takeaways. Is Gonzaga still the best team in the country? Like, where do you kind of rank Tennessee in that conversation? Is Admiral Schofield your new favorite basketball player, or is it still Brandon Clark?
I guess my big takeaway from the game isn't that I lose any faith in Gonzaga. I mean, they, you know, were a bucket away from winning without arguably their second or third best player in Killian Tilly, and I think Gonzaga's looked great all season. They're skilled offensively. I think they have a little bit of room for growth defensively. I certainly think that they'll be better with Tilly and also with Geno Crandall when he comes back. But I see no reason to doubt Gonzaga. My major takeaway is that I think you have to elevate Tennessee into the pantheon of teams that you know, is certainly title caliber. And my concern with Tennessee going into the season was, you know, did we see them kind of max it out last year? Like, was that as good as this group of, you know, 2- and 3-star recruits could be? And not that they were going to be bad or take a step backwards this season, but were they just going to plateau and be a top tier SEC team that didn't quite have enough to make that jump to the top tier nationally? And, you know, watching them outplay Kansas for long stretches of that game before, you know, really going toe-to-toe with Gonzaga and obviously having the stronger finishing kick even without Grant Williams, I think that was really encouraging for Tennessee. And I think it says that this is not only an SEC contender this year, but also a team that, you know, can avoid the opening round loss that it had last year in the NCAA tournament and go on to challenge for a Final Four and even a title.
Sounds like kid number one agreed with that assessment.
My daughter has woken up from her nap and is currently pounding on the door of the room that we're in. So we'll see if her mom comes along to corral her or not.
Oh, man, I've been there before. all right, so yeah, I pretty much agree with you. I think that Admiral Schofield is the guy. You know, if he's going to play, he's not always going to play like he did last night. Like, he was unbelievable. He had 30 points. He scored 25 in the second half. He scored the last 11 for Tennessee in the final 3:18 of that game. And he made two threes in the final, I want to say it was like the minute and 6 seconds that ended up giving them the win. Both of those were go-ahead threes. One of them put Tennessee up 73-71. And the other one was the game winner with 22 seconds left. So if he's going to play anything close to that level, then I think that Tennessee is, like, that's where their jump came, right? Like, I agree with you, or I agreed with you in the preseason in terms of not knowing where Tennessee's improvement was going to come from. Like, when you see a sophomore or when you see a freshman that's becoming a sophomore, what's the best, what do coaches always say about that, right? The best thing about freshmen is they become sophomores. That's where the jump comes from. Everyone on Tennessee's roster and in the rotation was like, they were already old. They were already like sophomores and juniors and upperclassmen that don't necessarily take that next jump. But it looks like Admiral Schofield kind of has. And like he's an interesting NBA guy to me too, because, you know, he's built like a wrestler. He's 6'5". He is athletic enough that he's going to be able to guard guys that are bigger than him, but also guard guys that are smaller than him. He can obviously make threes. There's kind of like a toughness to him, a physicality to him, and like he's got this air of professionalism to him in terms of how hard he works and the way that he's kind of diligent about continuing to get better and to continuing to get, like, if you talk to people around the Tennessee program, they'll basically tell you he's the hardest worker on the team. Yeah. So, and it, I mean, it's not by much either. Like that group is just a bunch of hardworking dudes that are super competitive, that play with a chip on their shoulder. So,
and also like just so big and strong. Like, yes. I mean, there were points in that game where they dwarfed that Gonzaga front line, and that's not a small group by any means. Like that was impressive to me. And then I guess the other thing I took away from that last play, like if you're Gonzaga, how do you leave Admiral Schofield for that three-pointer? Like, how many does he need to hit before you want to get a hand in his face? Like, especially when Grant Williams isn't on the court, like, that's the guy that you have to stop and to, you know, leave him free off that ball screen. That was surprising to me, because I'm sure that was something that was talked about in the huddle before that play.
Yeah, that's the other impressive thing about it, is not only were they without Grant Williams for the final 3 minutes, when Schofield scored all 11 of those points down the stretch, but they didn't have Lamont Turner either.
Yeah,
I think he comes off the bench for him, but he's one of like the three guards that they kind of have in that rotation with the two Jordans, Jordan Bone and Jordan Bowden, and I can never remember which one's the point guard and which one plays off the ball because their names are basically the same. but he's the like kind of the third guy in that rotation, and he wasn't there with, I think it was a shoulder injury. I can't remember. But yeah, but that was really, really, really impressive. And it was the second time that they've played a top five team on a neutral court, and it's the second time that it was a one-possession basketball game. Obviously, they lost to Kansas in New York City. Actually, it was in Brooklyn in overtime in another game where Grant Williams fouled out down the stretch, which is probably a conversation that we need to have at some point about whether or not this guy is a little bit too foul prone. Before we get into the conversation about like how you would rank the top seven and whether or not there's a clear cut top seven, I do want to ask you this question, because it's a question that I've kind of been going back and forth with people on privately. Who is Gonzaga's best player? Because the way that the dynamics of that team and the way it breaks down is really fascinating to me. So who would you call the best player on Gonzaga?
So I'm still gonna go with Rui, but I would hedge a little bit. Their best all around player is Brandon Clark. The guy who can get hot in a moment and carry them is Zach Norvell. And then I still think Rui is their go to scorer and the guy who they would go to for a bucket down the stretch, like what we saw with the Washington game. So like,
and the Duke game too. He scored the game winning bucket against Duke.
Right, that too. Yeah, exactly. And I think he's the guy who's best capable of creating his own shot. He's so deadly in that mid-range game. He can attack and transition. I still think like he's evolving and growing into that role. So I think he's going to get better and better as the course of the season goes along. Like, I understand why people wouldn't say Rui, because like Brandon Clark just does so many different things for them. Like, he's so effective defensively. He's obviously a really good rebounder. Like I get the Brandon Clark love and I share it, but if you're asking me who Gonzaga's go-to guy is and who their best player is, I'm still going to stick with Rui.
Yeah, you know, I don't necessarily disagree. I do think that Rui is an All-American, and we're kind of like picking between vanilla and chocolate ice cream when we kind of dive into this stuff. But the reason I bring it up is because I think Rui is like definitively their biggest star and probably the guy that like gets deserved All-American love. Not only because of the fact he's their leading scorer and he's the guy that's made two game-winning shots for him already this season, but because of the whole, you know, he could end up being like this Japanese star and doing the same things for basketball in Japan that Yao Ming did for basketball in China and all that kind of stuff. And You know, so I get it. I understand why he's the star. I understand why he's the guy that gets the attention, and it's all deserved. I think that you can make the argument that Brandon Clark is the most impactful player on the floor because of what he's able to do defensively. You know, he's an elite rim protector. He can jump passing lanes. He's able to switch and guard on smaller on ball screens. He's a very, very, very – he might be the single best defender in all of college basketball this year, and I don't think that that's saying it too much. Like, his ability to defend is the reason he's going to get drafted. He's also averaging 16 points and 8 boards. So he's just – picking between him and Rui Hachimura for who's the best player on that basketball team is a good problem for Mark Few to have. But I would also say that the most important player on that team is Josh Perkins because, one, like, I'm not – he's talented – but I'm still not convinced that he's consistent enough from game to game and play to play. Like that's a concern I have with whether or not this team can win a national title is can Josh Perkins play at the level that he needs to play for 6 games in March? And I think we saw a little of it yesterday come to fruition and some of that concern pop up. I don't think he scored. I want to say he was 0-for-6 from the floor. He didn't have the turnovers.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I mean, again, 0-for-6 from the floor and 0 points is a problem. Don't get me wrong. But, like, I think they would take 9 assists and 1 turnover from him and take their chances. Like, it's when he gets out of control and gets a little turnover prone that they've gotten in trouble in years past. And I think he's been better in that regard so far this year. I'm certainly not saying that that's their greatest strength by any means. Like, they're better in other positions on the floor. But I like the fact that Josh Perkins has played more under control. And before the Geno Crandall injury, I also liked that they had another guy to initiate offense for them, which they didn't really have last year. So I think that there have been some encouraging signs for Josh Perkins, but I agree with you that that's one of the concerns about Gonzaga, along with a little bit defensively. Like, I think Killian Tilly will help with this because he has the same ability that that Brandon Clark does to guard out to the perimeter and to switch onto guards and be effective in that way. He's not quite the rim protector that that Brandon Clark is, but he's not bad in his own right. So I think that that will help. But I think that's where Gonzaga still has the most room for growth right now is on the defensive end.
Yeah, I agree with all of that 100%. But I think what makes Josh Perkins the most important are the concerns that we mentioned and the fact that he doesn't have a natural backup at this point. And then I think you can make the argument that Zach Norvell is their most dangerous player because, like, that dude can go from not making a shot for 35 minutes to hitting, like, 4 straight threes in 4 possessions to win a game for him. Like, he's just – the way that he can go from – the way that he can get hot in the snap of fingers is just unbelievable. And if I was an opposing coach, that would be very, very scaring to me. And
they go from very good to very, very, very difficult to beat when he gets on one of his, you know, 16 points in 10 minute stretches like he's had a few times this year and had in the NCAA tournament a couple times last year. I don't know if they're the best offensive team in the country. That might be Duke, but they're really close. They're so skilled. And then when you add Tilly's ability to stretch the floor and, bring that opposing big out of the paint, I only think they get better.
Yeah, it's just everything about that team is an interesting dynamic. So let me ask you this, Jeff. I think that there is a clear-cut top 7 in college basketball right now. I would make the argument that it's Kansas, Duke, Gonzaga, Michigan, Virginia, Nevada, and who am I missing? Oh, Tennessee. And it's all 7 of them. I think that most people are probably going to have Kansas, Tennessee, Gonzaga, and Duke as the top 4, probably in that order because Kansas beat Tennessee, Tennessee beat Gonzaga, and Gonzaga beat Duke. All of those games were on a neutral court. All of those games were one possession basketball games. Would you agree that that is the top 7 in college hoops, and how would you go about, I guess, ranking those 7?
Yeah, I would agree that that's the top 7. I think the only teams you could even make arguments for, maybe Auburn, maybe Michigan State, maybe North Carolina, but I wouldn't put any of those teams into the top 7. I don't know if it's a huge gap between that top 7 and some of those teams I just mentioned, but I think there's a clear line in terms of accomplishments so far this season among those 7 and the rest. How would I order them? Like, I guess it depends on, are we ranking for, you know, what they've achieved so far this year, who I still think is the most likely to win a title.
That's the differentiation. So when it comes down to who has the best resume, like, it's Kansas, and I don't really necessarily think it's all that close. But I would also say that the way that these teams are playing right now, it's very clear that there is a top five, or at least to me, there's Duke. Then there is a top five that includes Tennessee, Gonzaga, Michigan, and Virginia. And then I would say Kansas is clearly sixth out of that group. And then I would have Nevada clearly seventh. And then I would have all of them a pretty big step above that Auburn, Michigan State, North Carolina, Virginia Tech, Florida State tier.
Yeah, I largely agree with everything you just said. I don't even know if I would put Duke in its own tier, but like my biggest point is Kansas has the best resume, but I don't think Kansas is playing the best basketball out of any team in the country. Like I would take either Tennessee or Gonzaga based on what I saw over the weekend over the Jayhawks on a neutral today. I think especially like if you're going to tell me that the Doak is out for a while, that they don't get D'Souza back for a while, that LeGerald Vick becomes mortal LeGerald Vick as opposed to, you know, the superhuman who shot them through a couple of games earlier this season. I have more concerns with Kansas than I do with some of those other teams that we've mentioned.
Yes, we very much agree with all of that. Kansas has now, granted, every team that they have played looks like they might be the best team in there. All the mid-major teams they played look like they might be the best team in their league, but they still struggled at home with Vermont. They still struggled at home with Louisiana. They struggled at home and got taken to overtime by Stanford. They struggled at home with Wofford for the first like 28 minutes of that game. They struggled at home with New Mexico State and only won that game by 3. So I'm just not, I don't know. There's something that doesn't necessarily make sense and is not all working with that team, but I think it's a credit to Bill Self. They're still undefeated. They have wins over.
And here's the thing, like who's the second best team in the Big 12? Like they have a long time to figure out their problems, if you know what I mean. Like I'm sure they're going to take some losses on the road in conference. They always do. But like, I mean, is the best team in the Big 12 Iowa State? Because it's not Kansas State, as I know we're going to discuss later. I don't think it's West Virginia right now.
I would argue it's Texas Tech. I love Texas Tech.
Yeah, it might be Texas Tech. You're probably right. But whatever it is, like I don't see another elite team in the Big 12 this year. And I think that gives Kansas some time to, get some of its pieces back and kind of work through its problems.
I'm glad that you let me get that rant out because it's very frustrating going and checking my Twitter mentions right now because I have Kansas ranked sixth. And I don't know. Like I get it because they have the best resume and the wins do matter, which is why I would say that if we were doing NCAA tournament seeding right now, Kansas would be the number one overall seed. But they wouldn't. They probably wouldn't be the favorite in Vegas, and they wouldn't be the team that I was going to put my money on to win the tournament. And people get hung up on this idea that like winning a game on a neutral court is proof that one team is better. But when it's a one possession game, or it's a game that goes to overtime, like that's not proof of anything beyond the fact that Kansas, I don't want to call it luck because people think about luck and just think that it's not something that is based off of the way that a team played, right? Like Kansas went out and they won the game. But if that game gets played 10 times, Tennessee probably wins 5 of them and Kansas probably wins 5 of them. Same thing with Duke and Gonzaga in Maui. And I would probably argue that if they played that game 10 times, Duke would win that game 7 times, right?
Yeah. Same thing with
Gonzaga and Tennessee. Like if they play that game 10 times, I think that Gonzaga probably wins 5 or 6 of them. So that matters when you rank who is the best team and not necessarily who is the best resume. And at this point, what the polls have kind of become is a like who has the best resume. And I mean, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. That's the way people want to rank teams. And if that's what we want to do, they don't matter. Polls don't matter. So whatever. But that's not necessarily the way that I want to rank teams, because if I want to rank them in terms of who is the best team, then I don't think that you can sit there. I don't even think the most diehard Kansas fan can sit there and tell me with a straight face that they think right now Kansas is better than some of those teams.
Yeah, I would imagine that most people would agree that if you put Kansas and Duke on a neutral court 10 times, that Kansas isn't winning 6 of those, you know?
Yes. You'd hope.
It's all philosophical about how you rank. Like, do you rank it on resume? Do you rank it on who you think would win that day? Like, whatever. There's lots of different ways to do it. None of them are wrong. But yeah, if you're asking me how does Kansas compare among those seven, I don't think Kansas is the best team today. That doesn't mean that might not change over the next couple months, but I think some of those teams are playing better ball than Kansas is today.
All right. Talk to me about Kentucky. Would you still have them in the top 25 as of today?
I tend to rank when I do that sort of stuff on a little bit more on resume than you do, but I don't think it matters. Like regardless of how you rank, unless you're ranking based on who you think will be good by the end of the season, I don't see how Kentucky is in the top 25 today. Like, they haven't achieved enough, you know? Like, they've played two particularly good teams. They played one really good team and gotten completely outclassed by Duke. And then I think it's alarming how many close games they've played against lesser teams, culminating in the loss to Seton Hall. And, you know, when you need a miracle half-court shot just to force overtime and then you can't finish that off against a Seton Hall team that's, you know, not bad, but I mean, I don't know. If I was betting, I'd bet NIT over the NCAA tournament for Seton Hall right now. So I don't think that was a great loss. I don't think there's anything that they've achieved in their wins that suggests that they're a top 25 team today. That doesn't mean that they won't figure it out, but, you know, they're not shooting great from three. They're not taking away threes from other teams. Their sophomores haven't really progressed as much as I was hoping that they would. You know, I think their freshmen have had moments, but, you know, I certainly don't think they've been anywhere near as dominant as like the Duke freshmen, for example, or even as some previous Kentucky freshman classes. So I think there's time to fix this, but like the hope that, you know, having more experience than most of the John Calipari teams of the past would lead this Kentucky team to be, you know, kind of elite from start to finish, as opposed to progressing to elite by the end of the season. I think we've seen that that's just not going to come to fruition with this group. And now the question is, can they, you know, make that climb that some of the other Kentucky teams have in the past? And I certainly think that's possible. But I will say, I'm not sure there's the same level of elite talent on this Kentucky team that there have been in some of the ones in the past. And I'm sure you've discussed that before, but like, you know, there just isn't a surefire top five, top 10 pick on this roster. So you're looking for those sophomores to make a jump. You're looking for those freshmen to make a jump. And I think that'll happen. But I'm not sure that this group climbs as high as some of the best Kentucky teams have previously.
I'd argue that Keldon Johnson is a top 10 pick, but with the caveat being that he's kind of like, I compared him earlier this year to kind of like a Miles Bridges in terms of, he is a very good complementary piece. Like, in an ideal world, he is a guy that is one of your best defenders, one of your best competitors, a guy that you want attacking closeouts, a guy that can make a three, a guy that is going to play really, really, really hard for you, but he's not necessarily the guy you want being the star of your team. And I think that he's kind of forced into a situation where he is going to be asked to be more of a star than is probably ideal, if that makes sense. So, yes, I agree with your point that there's not as much star power on this team. And, you know, in terms of talking about the top 25, like, they've played one team in the KenPom top 50 and they lost that game by 34 points, right? The only other high major team that they've played this season in the KenPom top 75 was Seton Hall. And they went to overtime against a team whose two best players spent the first 35 minutes of that game playing like they were shaving points. Miles Powell, who is their leading scorer, who is, I want to say, he's averaging 22 points a game before this game, had 8 points with 5 minutes left, and then went absolutely crazy, had 17 points in the last 5 minutes to get Seton Hall to where they could, they had a lead with 1.5 seconds left. Miles Kale, who is the second leading scorer on Seton Hall, was 3 for 17 from the floor when he hit that game-winning three with 9.5 seconds left in overtime. So, like, Kentucky, playing against a probably NIT-bound Seton Hall, couldn't win despite the fact that Seton Hall's two best players did not play well at all. That's not a good sign. Neither is the fact that they've struggled with Southern Illinois. Neither is the fact that they struggled with UNC Greensboro. Neither is the fact that they struggled with VMI. Neither is the fact that they struggled with Winthrop. Like, they just have not looked all that impressive. And you mentioned the three-point shooting. Yes, that's a concern. You know what else is a concern? The fact that this team has 3 5-star point guards on the roster, and they turn the ball over on more than 20% of their possessions. That's a bad sign too.
Yep. And then also, like, so the best thing that Kentucky has done all season is get on the offensive glass, right? And, like, I'm not saying that that's not going to be a weapon for them all season, but that's a heck of a lot easier against North Dakota and VMI and Winthrop than it's going to be against Tennessee and Auburn and Florida, you know? So, like, I still think that they'll be one of the best offensive rebounding teams in the country, but as that margin starts to diminish in conference play, how else are they going to score? And, I mean, that means that those point guards need to get a lot more efficient. It means that Tyler Harrow needs to start hitting those outside shots that he did in high school. And that means that they just need more ways to score besides that. So I think that that's the biggest area that that Kentucky needs to fix, is they need to find some other offensive options besides the offensive glass.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know, man. Like, we were in this exact same spot last year with Kentucky, right? So I don't doubt that Cal is going to find a way to figure it out. Like, that's what he does.
Think they'll get better. Like, the pattern for Kentucky is always that they always get better over the course of the year, whether that switch flips in February or January or sometimes even not until March. I'm sure they'll get better, but, like, it's a long way to go from where Kentucky is today to title contender.
Yeah, and, you know, Cal is – he doesn't really get, like, a ton of credit for being a great basketball coach. Like, people know him as more of a guy that is a recruiter more than anything else, right? Like, that's what his reputation is. And, look, he's not John Beilein. He's not one of these offensive masterminds. He's not Tony Bennett. He's not a guy that's changing the way that people play defense. He's not doing any of that, right? But his teams just always get better and better and better throughout the year, even though that the stuff that they run is, for the most part, pretty basic. And, like, the teams that he throws out there are always going to be kind of old school in the sense that they don't really play. Like, when was the last time Kentucky played truly small ball? They don't really do it, you know? This year, they're pretty much always going to have P.J. Washington at the four, maybe with Reed Travis, maybe with Nick Richards, maybe with E.J. Montgomery. But they haven't really embraced the idea of going with, like, three wings on the floor at the same time, right? So it's not like he's reinventing anything. Like, you know, honestly, like, I think that you can make the argument that he needs to find someone to put on a staff that's going to come up with new innovative ideas offensively. Because how many times do we have to have this conversation about Kentucky where it's like, well, you know, they're pretty good defensively and that'll carry them for a while. They got to figure out how to score. They never really can shoot. Like, they don't really get easy shots. They're not all that easy to watch offensively. Like, how many times are we going to have that conversation about a Kentucky team? It's over and over and over again. So, he is very, very good at finding ways to get players to buy into what he wants them to do, right? And he is very, very good at figuring out who his team is and who are the players that are going to be the best fit. And he's really good at getting teams to be improved throughout the year. Like, that always happens with them, right? We always have these questions about Kentucky in November and December, and they always end up being, you know, as good as we thought. Like, last year, they would have made the Final Four if P.J. Washington could hit a damn free throw in the Sweet 16, right? So,
yes, now admittedly with the greatest draw in the history of mankind, but nonetheless, they had improved dramatically over the course of last season, just like they had, so many times before. Like, I'm with you that, like, I wouldn't call Cal a tactician necessarily, but he gets his kids to buy in. Nobody is above the team. The teams improve over the course of the season, and ultimately, I think he does a great job. But I will say, just kind of like you were saying about, you know, adding an offensive mind as an assistant. I mean, we saw what that did for John Beilein, adding Luke Jaklic the last two seasons and kind of shoring up the defense that had been an issue for Michigan. I'd be really interested to see what an offensive mind could do with the talent that Kentucky attracts year after year, and whether there's a way that you can offset the shooting being a weakness or spread the floor in a different way or just run some different stuff and maybe make them a little bit less predictable. I don't know, but it would be really interesting to see whether that would change the dynamic of Kentucky.
You know, I don't know if it would, but it's just the thing that took John Beilein from being a great offensive coach to being a guy that is great at running this Michigan program and took him to the national title game last year and is now on the verge of having to be, you know, a Final Four contender, potential national champion again this year, is he identified the leak, right? He figured out where his program was not as efficient as it probably should be, and he went and he hired a guy to fix that. And yeah. I had Brendan Quinn, who covers Michigan for The Athletic, who is as good as any beat writer in college basketball, getting to know the programs that he covers, and probably knows that Michigan program better than anybody that is not actually in that Michigan program.
Yep.
And like he basically said that the I had him on the podcast, and he basically said that John Beilein kind of had this epiphany that was like, look, all I do is sit here and think about offense. Even when we're playing defense, I think about what we're going to do on the next offensive possession. So why am I wasting my time worrying about defense when I could just go out and hire a guy to do that while I'm thinking about the offense? And look at what it's done for Michigan defensively. Look what it's done for the basketball program and the success that they're having. So I would advocate for Cal finding some innovative offensive mind to put on his staff. I said the same thing, you know, last week when we talked about Shaka Smart and what's going on with Texas. You know, I would advocate having him go out and find an innovative offensive mind that's going to figure out how to make that team work a little bit better than they are currently working. So the last thing I want to talk to you about, Jeff, is Kansas State. And I have a super hot take that I'm going to fire at you. I want to know what you think about it. So I think that Bruce Weber is under more pressure now than he's ever been under at Kansas State. And here's why I say that. Because there's always been some rumblings about Kansas State fans not being super excited with him as their head coach and being disappointed that they have not gotten back to some of the successes that they had under Frank Martin, right? There's been talk about him being on the hot seat and talk about the potential of him losing his job and the frustration that Brad Underwood, an alum of Kansas State, has been hired not once but twice since 2016 while Kansas State still has Bruce Weber as their coach. Well, now he's in a situation where he entered this season as a preseason top 15 team, right? Coming off an elite eight run, all the expectations in the world, and it does not look like they are necessarily going to end up being as good as people thought they would be. And the worst thing that could happen to a team that isn't necessarily all that good is to have expectations that are totally out of whack with how good the team is. And so I guess what my question is, if Kansas State can't figure this thing out, and they're looking at another situation where they're like a 9-9 team in the Big 12, they end up sneaking in the tournament as a 10 seed, they end up being someone that loses in the first round of the tournament, does there get to be a point where Bruce Weber, like the frustration that fan base has is just too much for him to take?
Too much for him to take or too much for that administration to take?
Because all, I think that's all of the above.
Yeah, like I definitely think that there's going to be that level of fan angst in Manhattan if this isn't at least like one of the challengers to Kansas in the Big 12 and a team that, you know, looks like it can make the second week of the tournament again. And right now, obviously, they're not there. So, like, you know, there's always that old saying that, like, once you're on the hot seat, you never really get off of it. And I'm not sure I buy that 100% of the time, but I think it's probably true in Bruce Weber's case. Like, I think he's going to need a couple of years of sustained success, you know, like they had at the end of last season, in order for him to feel truly safe and truly valued by Kansas State. And like, it does put him in a precarious position, the expectations going into this season, because I think most years at Kansas State, if you make the NCAA tournament, that's a success. Like, I know the level that they reached under Frank Martin, but like, that's the outlier historically for that program. The problem is that Bruce is following that. And so, like, there's the expectation that he has that success year in and year out. And I think he's done okay there, but I don't think he's been great. And I think missing on Brad Underwood, you know, because they decided to keep him, certainly is something that sticks in the craw of a lot of Kansas State fans. They feel like that was a missed opportunity. And so, you know, anywhere that he doesn't achieve up to the level of expectation for the program, I think that that's always going to be a point of angst for them. And, you know, like you said, the expectations were high this year. They were, you know, top 20, top 15 going into the season. And they won the first six games. They looked okay. Decent win over Missouri in that stretch on a neutral floor. But, you know, to get outclassed by Marquette and then score 46 points against a Tulsa team that I don't really anticipate talking about much this year, that's concerning. And I think just the state of their offense as a whole is pretty concerning. You can't be 313th in the country in three-point shooting and expect to contend for the Big 12 title.
Especially when your whole thing is playing small with like three or four guards and Dean Wade as your center. You can't be a team that can't score. You have to be able to score. And so here's, I think the interesting thing in all of this is like, at the end of the day, like the Elite Eight run might end up being a bad thing for like Bruce Weber's career. And that's because, like, if you look at what they did last season, you made the point earlier when we were talking about the Pac-12, how teams in other conferences kind of get floated no matter what they do in the non-conference just because they play in the league with all those good teams. And that is Kansas State to a T. The best win that they had in non-conference last year was Vanderbilt, who was a borderline top 100 team on KenPom, right? Beyond that, the only other good team that they played in the non-conference was Arizona State, and they lost to them on a neutral court, and Georgia, who they had to play in that SEC Big 12 challenge thing, right? And then in league play, they got swept by West Virginia, they got swept by Texas Tech, they got swept by Kansas, and they lost to Kansas in the Big 12 tournament. So against the top three teams, the three teams in that league that we all thought were Final Four contenders, Kansas State went 0-7 against them.
Yep.
And then they made the NCAA.
Nobody was better against TCU and Baylor than Kansas State was.
Yes, exactly. And then they make the NCAA tournament, right? And they go out and they beat an okay Creighton team who was good but wasn't necessarily great, which is a fine win, right? Creighton was a 9 seed, or Creighton was an 8 seed. That's fine, right? And then they advance and they beat UMBC because UMBC knocked off Virginia. So they get to the Sweet 16. Then they take on a Kentucky team that like is fine as well. But Kentucky, P.J. Washington was 8 for 20 from the free throw line in that game. That's why they made it to the Elite Eight, where they went out and they got drubbed by Loyola. So there was all these expectations because of the NCAA tournament run they made last year. But the reason they got to the NCAA tournament is because they were pretty good against the OK teams in the Big 12. And then they went out and they got lucky that Virginia lost to UMBC. And then they got kind of lucky that P.J. Washington forgot how to make free throws in the Sweet 16. So I say all that to say this, like, maybe they just weren't all that good to begin with. But I wonder if the fact that they had all these expectations coming into the year is the kind of thing where it ends up being the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak.
Yeah, I definitely agree that, like, let's say Virginia beats UMBC and then rolls them in the second round of the tournament, that they wouldn't have been ranked as highly as they were coming into the season. And then maybe, like, you know, again, the expectation is get back to the NCAA tournament for Bruce, and they could easily still do that. But in terms of them being a top 15 team in the country, they have a long ways to go offensively, and I agree with you that that could cause some problems for Bruce Weber at the end of the season if, you know, they're merely just okay or decent but not the top 20 team we were expecting.
Well, Jeff, listen, man, I think I've kept you here long enough. We've had 45 minutes worth of overreactions, and I don't know if you can hear it in the background, but my cat is getting in a fight with my dog, and my 3-year-old son just got home, and now he is the one that's trying to moderate the fight between the cat and the dog by screaming at the cat and at the dog. So I got to go handle the situation. I appreciate you guys checking listening to the podcast. If you want to find Jeff on Twitter, it's at Jeff Eisenberg, right?
Yep, correct.
So go follow him on Twitter. And I appreciate you guys listening. Jeff, always a pleasure, my man.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. Follow me on Twitter.
Give me 5 stars.